This is the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show number 174. You're listening to the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. You can find us at pitchvision.com. You can call us on
020-88-167-691.
And you can email us on
coach@pitchvision.com.
My name's David Hinchliffe, and this week I'm joined by Mark Garraway and Berners. Welcome to the show, Garris. Welcome to the show, Berners.
Morning. How are you?
Morning.
Morning, afternoon, or evening, depending on when the people of the future are listening to this.
Good point.
Yeah. So wherever you are, whenever you are, it could be 1,000 years in the future, and we'll still be floating around the ether.
Wouldn't that be nice to think that people are listening to us in 1,000 years?
Yeah, as some kind of artifact of a lost civilization.
I'm on Mars. It's me they sent.
You're on tour of Mars.
Yeah. Watching the Olympics from above. Monitoring crowd flow.
The first intergalactic games. What's been happening this week, Berners?
This week we have pretty much disintegrated at the top of the Middlesex Premier League second division. Mm. Having lost the last two games, we now lie in third place. Our season is in tatters. Not many people attending training. I feel that the season's passed us by without really even blinking. We now move into the final four games, needing to win every single game and gain maximum points.
That's interesting about how the people tend to drift away if things don't quite go according to plan. Is that a common thing, do you think?
Just training.
Yeah.
Our training attendance has been absolutely appalling. I don't know whether it's because of the weather. I think people's like whole spirit towards cricket's not really in 100% kind of commitment at the moment because of the breakup that the weather's caused and the people watching the Olympics and stuff like that. I think there's been other things. The European Championships football was on as well. It's about the worst season I've had for about a decade, I think, in terms of just enjoyment and buzz and good weather and success. It's been terrible.
You do get that slight jaded feeling, even at club level, don't you, as the season goes on? It just goes to show, doesn't it, Gareth, how tough it must be. You must have seen that firsthand, how tough it is for international players who are doing it day in, day out. I mean, if you get a little bit jaded towards the end of the cricket season and you're only playing once a week.
Well, it affects your rhythm in international cricket because obviously you're used to being on the go. You're used to being to playing and bowling a lot of balls and batting against a lot of balls. And it isn't just in the matches that it affects your rhythm. It's also your preparation because international cricket is far more of a preparation program and it is a competition one, so you do have gaps, and you see that England have now got and South Africa have now got a significant gap before that vital third test match at Lord's. And if the weather doesn't perk up, then that will affect both teams' preparation, both teams would like to go in with a perfect preparation phase where a couple of them have gone away and played some games. South Africa have got a game in between. They'd want to get as many overs out of that as possible. You want to be in outdoor nets. You want to be facing balls on wickets that are very similar to what you're going to be facing on probably quite a flat wicket at Lord's. It affects the rhythm of your preparation. And it's been interesting this week looking at the county championship in England and how the weather has affected that. And it's been very difficult for sides to get on a roll and get a bit of momentum going in the competition. And as a result, it's going to be a really tight finish. And I just hope that whoever ends up playing the best cricket gets the best opportunity to win it, because that's what you want from any competition. But this year, the weather might get in the way of that.
The other thing that I wanted to talk about this week was captaincy and the difference maybe the gap that's breaking out between the top level of captaincy and the and lower levels where there's less analysis and that kind of thing. Gareth, how much have you seen the importance of the analyst come into captaincy at the top level?
Well, yes, it's coming in, and as sports move on, and you've only got to look at the British cycling team, track cycling team, to work out how much analysis plays a role. But it is only a role because ultimately your coaches and your captains in cricket have to take that information and use it to the best of their ability. So I think the easy bit is to get the information, because that's just down to man hours. It's down to studying statistics, which are always out there. It's down to interpreting those statistics, but it's then putting it into play that's the important bit. So the art of captaincy is still there. It's just that the information is probably more objective nowadays that the captains get to consider, rather than the subjectivity and the gut feel, which they were basing pretty much all of their decisions on in years gone by. So you look at somebody like a Mike Brearley. He was making his decisions based on his training, outside of being a captain, being based on his natural feel for people and his gut feel for situations. Now, Mike Brearley, given some objective data, now that would have been a very exciting mix, I think, to see in modern day cricket, because he'd have been able to pull on different types of information to make an even more informed decisions than one he was making, you know, in 1980, 1981.
And Berners, how much have you seen? I mean, obviously it's a lot different at club level. There isn't the resources available for analysis. But Berners, how much have you seen an increase in the more scientific side of analysis come into the club game at the top level that your club plays at?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, there are a few kind of, you see a couple of guys now using similar kind of apps and software which they use at the top level, which you can now pick up for free on iPads and iPhones, and they'll give them inevitably more knowledge about their own team, you know, telling their own players maybe after the game what kind of areas they hit the ball in or what kind of areas the guy's bowled in. But not greatly. I mean, I have been, as Gareth's role was with England, I've been with those guys, and it's actually fascinating to see the ins and outs of their daily regime, if you like, of how they, you know, they've constantly got a tripod and a video under their arm, and they're at training, they're at the live game, and the, you know, the processes they go through are monotonous, but at the end of the day they manage to capture massive data pools of information, which even the tiniest segment might make a massive difference to a particular game scenario or a particular venue or a particular opponent. So I think it's like anything, it will eventually creep down into the amateur game, and it's all dependent on human resources and finance. As with many things, you then need someone else to travel with your team. You know, many teams at the moment at an amateur level struggle to find scorers. Well, if you can't find a scorer, what chance have you got with, you know, for a guy to sit there with a video camera and actually video the whole day's game? You'd also question what the value was in it. You know, is it actually worth us going into this much level for cricket at this level as well? So a few things to consider, I guess, but I can see it. I can see definitely some teams taking that more professional approach for sure in the ECB Premier League leagues around the country and around the world, in the top leagues, in the grade competitions around Australia and things like that.
So, Gareth, is there a way that club and school level can bring a little bit more analysis into captaincy, or do you just need those resources? I know we've talked about looking at score cards and average scores on grounds, but is there any other things that you can do?
Well, I think that's a start, and you know, the bottom line is, in match play, the analyst is ultimately creating a library of events, and the most basic library of events is what happens in each individual ball, and you've actually got that with your scorecards. And for years, I've watched people do scorebooks, and I did scorebooks myself. And whilst they're a great record of a match, how much information have we actually gleaned from them in order to improve our games? And I'd say very little, because once a match is played, the only thing that most people are interested in is their averages. Yet there's a lot more to be taken from a scorebook. So to me, the most basic form of analysis is a scorebook, and we should be using them a lot better. And that's where venue stats come in. That's where dot ball percentages can be calculated. You know, the apps now that you can get on your iPads and your iPhones are fantastic for creating that type of information, but then you still have to extract that information from the iPad, stick it into a spreadsheet for it to actually monitor people's performance. And then that's all I'm doing now. I've got no specialist kit like I used to have with with England. However, what I'm able to do is to put systems in place and make my own systems using these new applications that you can get hold of on iPhones and iPads to actually do the same sort of thing, but it costing a fraction of the amount that ECB invested into it. So the principles are exactly the same. And I would stress the importance of getting your scorer to do your scorebook properly and then extracting data from it. Even if you only choose two or three things that you want to monitor each week, it's better than you just, you know, have doing things on a whim and just guessing what's going on. So that would be my starting point. And if you get that done, I'm convinced that over the course of a 1 or 2 years, then the advantage that you will have over your opposition and your competitors will be shown.
And then, of course, transitioning that data into a training environment where you can use our lovely pitch vision system to actually take the players through the paces in a training environment and then compare that to that of the live game, which in my mind is the 100% 360 degree solution to a game's appraisal and player analysis.
Well, it's the only way to do it, isn't it? Because we've talked about it today, about your attendance rates at Ealing going down. And we've got a question coming up later, which is sort of in relation to how do you practice? And the fact is that we need to motivate people and we need to give people things to encourage them to practice. And if we play a game on a Saturday, if we analyse it on a Monday, and if we practice on a Wednesday, specifically working on the things or continuing to galvanise the things that have been part of our game plan, then you're more likely to get people coming through the gate and wanting to practice. Whereas if you've got people just rocking up and doing their normal stuff, then the numbers will dwindle over the year, because that's the way it goes in club cricket. And we've all been there and seen that happen over the years. And we have to be giving more, because the expectation at the top level is going higher. And that's exactly what happens down the levels and down the different environments. And unless we can keep motivating people, then you're not going to get that attendance rate and then those performance hikes that come off of good training.
You mentioned two or three things there that you're looking at in performance. What would those top things be in your mind? Or maybe it varies between different coaches, but what would those top things be in your mind?
Well, it depends on the format that you're playing, but to me, you can't go too far away. If you monitor your batter's scoring ball percentage, not your strike rate, because strike rates are easy to calculate. And that's what people generally look at. So they look at Kevin Peterson struck at 90 runs per 100 balls in ODIs when he was playing. That was probably a contentious name to bring up this week. But you know, that's a given, and everybody knows their strike rate. And if you don't, then you're one of the very few. But actually, the scoring ball percentage is massively important. So that's the numbers of balls that you score off of, as opposed to the strike rate that you get, which is, you know, how many runs per 100 balls. So how many balls out of 100 do you score off, which enables you to continue the scoring to go on. But also, it means that you're changing strike, which means that the batter at the other end is getting a decent amount of strike, which means that he or she can be pushing their scoring ball percentage on. And a few years ago in ODI cricket, before the 2007 World Cup, most teams around the world were scoring off only 46% of balls that they were facing within a 50-over game. So less than 150 balls in a 300-ball innings were being scored off of. Now, if an alien landed on the earth and you said, oh, is this game of cricket and you only score off 50% of the balls that are played, they'd think, what a boring game that is. And as a result of those type of analysis and scoring ball percentage becoming an international benchmark within 50-over cricket, the game has gone to the next level, the next level, and the next level. And people are now scoring at nearly 60% of balls. And some players are scoring at, you know, 65 to 70% of balls. And that's massive. So conversely, you look for the bowler and their dot ball percentages. Now, again, if you understand the venue stats, if you understand dot ball percentages and scoring ball percentages, and I guarantee you, you'll be operating at a different level to any other team within your league presently. And if you can start working on that in games and then start working on that in practice, so you might set up a practice in the week, which is getting the ball into gaps. So instead of having a net practice, you convince your groundsman to get a middle practice going. So you play on the pitch maybe that you played out the previous Saturday. You stick a net along one side of it and you say, right, on the offside, we're going to look at picking up more singles. This is in order to raise your scoring ball percentage from 35% up to 50%. Over the course of the next 3 weeks, and we'll monitor it. I then think you become motivated to turn up to practice, because things that are measured tell you whether you're getting stronger at it, or give you a little sort of pull on the coat and say, you know, you need to start working a bit harder. So that's the sort of thing that I think every team should be doing, looking at your scoring ball percentage as a batting side and as individuals, and also dot ball percentage as a bowling side and as individuals within that bowling unit.
Okay, just to wrap up this little section, we're going to have our yes-no round. You only get one chance to answer yes or no, and you can't explain in any more detail what it is. So, Berners, you've got the questions this week. What are they?
Okay, first question. Should you select the captain from the best available players?
Yes.
Yes.
Second question, you should select the captain... Oh, hang on. Second question, you should select the captain from the best available captains.
No.
No.
Third question, captaincy is a position in its own right.
Yes.
No.
Okay, it's time now on the show to delve into the mailbag and find out what we've got. And this week, the best question, as the same as every week, gets a prize, which is an online coaching course, courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. So, Berners, you've got the two candidates this week. What's the first question?
First question is very topical to the flow of the show. It comes in from Paul, and he's a club player. He's just describing his club training and saying that a lot of blokes come and they just have a swing at anything. It's quite monotonous, the training, and they go through the same processes every week. More recently, he's tried to have a few training sessions which are a little bit more active and encourage kind of different things, both fielding, batting and bowling, to, you know, just change the landscape of their standard training. However, he still gets confronted with the odd moan and groan, and he's just wondering what we would advise him to do to make this training more productive on a more regular basis. And he's mentioned could you potentially make it more competitive, even offer bribes. So he's, you know, it must be a real problem here at his club. So what do you think, guys?
Yeah, it's a tricky one, and it's one that is faced by a lot of clubs, as you know yourself, Berners. People can go through the motions quite easily. I'd say that there's probably two things that you can look at, first of all. And one is to have someone who really tries to lead the way when it comes to the culture of training in the club. And in order to have someone doing that, you need people to buy into that, and somebody who has that job, whether it's formally or informally, that it's their job to make sure that the training is done right. What tends to happen with a lot of clubs is that because training doesn't really default to anyone, say the captain makes sure that there's some training going on, and then everybody rocks up, and then it kind of just defaults to this standard net thing where somebody bats for 8 minutes, everybody else bowls, and then somebody else pads up and they bat for 8 minutes, and it goes on like that until everybody just decides that they need to go home. So in order to change that kind of default setting, you need to have someone standing there going, right, this is what we're going to do this week. And maybe the thing that you do this week isn't necessarily any better than the turning your arm over, but the point is there's somebody there doing it and trying to make that difference. And then the second thing is the person who's doing it really needs to have the ultimate goal in mind. What are they trying to achieve, and how can you measure whether that success has been achieved or not? Where do you want to be at the end of the journey? You wouldn't go on a drive without knowing where your destination is very often. You want to know where you're going to end up, and it'd be quite nice to have a map to get there as well. So that would be the second thing I would say, is that make sure you know where you want to end up, as well as having someone to get you there in the first place. What do you think, Gareth?
Well, I mean, I'm trying to pick out a few things that were in the question here, and it appears that Paul's somebody who's a player, is very keen on his playing, but if he hasn't got a leadership role, it makes it very difficult for him to instill these things within the practice ethic. And obviously he's tried to do it a couple of times, but then, you know, the captain comes back or the rest of the players come back, and then they haven't got that way of looking at it. First things first, you've got to have quite a robust conversation with with the captain, and I don't know whether it's Paul or whether Paul goes to the club chairman and have a conversation with them and just say, look, you know, is there a way that we can facilitate a conversation to have those ask those questions that you've just put forward there, David. But that needs to happen because unless you get it done from the top and have a conversation involving people that can actually influence it, then there's a real danger that Paul will just probably annoy people more so than he will, you know, motivate people to do it. And his intentions are fantastic, but is there a right way or a better way of going about it and making a change in behaviour throughout the whole club? And I should imagine there is. You just need to find that route, and it might be through a chairman or a president or the chairman of selectors that I know a lot of clubs have got now to facilitate that type of conversation. Because the reason why those guys are involved in that club is that they want to see that club go forward. So I'm sure they'll be thinking it. And if they're not thinking it, it might be because they're not aware that this type of practice ethic is presently happening and it does need to shift. So, you know, let's go beyond what should happen and let's work out how you can get to have adult, robust conversations around the subject, because that's the starting point about it. In terms of motivation, one of the things that I do, if I've got resistance ever, and it doesn't happen very often, but if there's resistance to a fitness program or a change in training schedule or whatever, I'll always say to the players, well, let's give it three weeks and let's assess how we feel, how our results are, and how your individual results are at the end of it, and let's correlate whether it's worthwhile continuing to do. And generally, I'd back myself as a coach, and I'd back the methods that I've been taught down the year, that we would have a positive effect after those 3 weeks. But what I will ask is for everybody to give it absolutely 100% within those 3 weeks. And generally what happens, you get to the end of the 3 weeks and everybody realises that it was a good way to go about it, because it's, you know, ultimately it's good common sense anyway to work harder and work more specifically, and ultimately your goals will end up being materialising rather than not happening. So that's always an approach that I use. And he makes a good point here, make it competitive. Well, absolutely right. We talk about motivation. Competition is fantastic. So a real basic way of building some competition into a fielding, for example, it sounds as if a team don't do a massive amount of fielding, is to put a set of stumps up 20 metres away and just do some static throws and keep a log of it over the course of 3 or 4 weeks. So, you know, there's a ladder, there's a table that people can go up and down on. And, you know, it's a basic drill. It's something that we need to practice anyway. But you'll be amazed how many people actually start becoming competitive. You'd be amazed how many conversations go throughout the week as I'm going to beat you, or I'm going to get up the ladder or whatever. You'll be amazed how many people stay in the bar to gloat about their success because they've got something measured that they know that they are successful at. So that's just a small way of starting, but I think it goes back to robust conversations about practice ethic, full stop, giving it a 3 or 4 week period of doing it properly and everybody being motivated to do that properly and then assessing it, and then putting some competition in because people do like competition.
Tell you what was always competitive in Australia. They used to, when you used to train there, out was out. If you went in and practiced and you nicked it first ball, see ya. You're done.
Yeah, and it's good. I would say that's great, and it's a really good way of going about it. You can't do that too often because you end up demotivating somebody. So if somebody,
I'd never get a bat.
Yeah, exactly. So you know, which is great for the ones that can bat for hours on end, but not necessarily ones that can't. And also, it does encourage people to play defensively and not how you want them to play in a match. Whereas,
you're right there. How many times do you see a guy go into the nets that's an opener and leave the first six?
Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah, if he does that on a Saturday, particularly in the shorter formats of a game, then that's putting his team under pressure and everybody gets peed off of him. So another way of doing it, and we've discussed it previously on here, is having a 10-point practice where, you know, a player miss is worth -2. If you get out, it's worth -5. But you can also pick up runs by dropping the ball in front of you and simulating half a run by hitting one straight back over the top of the bowler. You pick up an extra 3 points, so that way you can actually accumulate your runs and you can bat for the whole session. You might get out twice, but because you're accumulating points which is actually what the game of cricket is all about, accumulating runs, then, you know, it's a much more productive session. The bowlers have got something in there as well, because, you know, you might say to them, right, once you've got 10 points, you can go off and get a drink and change your footwear and come back and have a bat. So that's the sort of way that I like to run our nets. But again, I wouldn't do that every single session by any stretch of imagination, because, you know, people get bored of that after a while.
Next question is in from James, and he's asking, lots of people talk about having a specific bowling plan after identifying a batsman's strengths and weaknesses. He's right there, and he says that you can normally do this just by looking at the way the players bat, so looking at things specifically, and he's wondering, you know, what these things are, how he holds the bat, how he moves the feet, and so on. He's also saying that as a spinner, typically the advice you get given is that you need to get batsmen driving on the front foot. However, if the batsman isn't doing this conventionally and starts to play in another way, how do you then exploit another batsman's weakness if he's not actually driving you? So over to you guys.
Having worked out on bowling plans on every player in the world over the last 10 years, this is probably going to sound a little bit bizarre, but what I've found is that actually it's more important about what every bowler's bowling plan is rather than every batter's bowling plan is. So and I'll try and quantify that. An example of somebody getting away from their own bowling strength to try and counteract weaknesses of batters was Stuart Broad about a year and a half ago, where he turned into this enforcer type position and started to bowl a lot more short balls and you know, being up in the batter's face. But actually it went away from what he was and the best bits of him as a bowler, and it's been interesting to watch him come back towards himself as a bowler and what his strengths are. So I think the starting point for everything is what your own strengths are. Then, you know, if you're a bang out length bowler and somebody is able to play that because their strengths are sort of capitalizing on what your strengths normally are, then you need to work out what their weaknesses are. But I think first and foremost, you need to bowl and actually bat, if you're a batter, to your own strengths before you start to shift your plan a little bit. I think too much emphasis, and this may come from television, is often placed on analysing the batters, when actually your best ball is good enough for most players in the world. And it was something that Graham Smith came over, and I was very keen on opposition analysis, and in 2005, and he said, Gareth, your plans are absolutely brilliant, but none of our bowlers can execute it because they're unable to, they're getting a bit confused about what their strengths are and what their weaknesses are, and they're going after bowling a wide half volley at this bloke early because that's his weakness, when actually you know, that their best bit is to hit length and build up pressure. So I would say have a look at what you're best at first, and you're obviously a spinner. You know, you've talked about inviting the batter to drive, which I encourage. I think it's really important to invite batters to drive, because the strike rates and the economy rates are very, very, the statistics are massive in favour of getting people to drive as a spinner. But the invitation to drive isn't an invitation if every ball you bowl is bowling up for somebody to come forward and drive. The invitation is the thing that drops through the letterbox and you go, oh, and it opens your eyes and it makes you excited. And that's what we're trying to do as spinners to batters, you know, so dropping the ball onto length, you know, maybe pushing them back a couple of times with a back of a length ball. That's, if you're an off spinner, that's spinning back into a right hander and tucking them up and then throwing the invitation through the letterbox. That's what's going to get people excited. They'll then come out, they'll choose the wrong ball and they'll get bowled through the gate or they'll get caught on the drive. So, I encourage people to spin the ball up and to get people to drive. But, you know, that invitation has to be an invitation rather than an open house policy, which is just getting the ball up there and hoping for the best. If they do move from a conventional tactic to one that a batter tries to start slog sweeping you and things, that's where your field positions come in. And you just shift them accordingly. And you try and block off that area and make them play in a more conventional way, even if you give a few runs. And as a spinner, I think, you know, you look at somebody, we were talking about Harbhajan, weren't we, the other day, and you're looking at his averages. His stats are still pretty good. They've dipped. But even now, his stats are still pretty good over his career. Yet he gets his wickets at 30. Now, most spinners in fast bowling, you'd say you'd want to get your wickets at less than 30 runs per wicket. But for a spinner, you've got 30 runs up your bag to play with a little bit. So, you know, if you do leave a gap and somebody whacks you through there for four, and the next ball you get them out because that's part of your plan, then to give four runs away is absolutely nothing in the overall context. So yeah, that's where your field positions come in. If you want to leave a gap to entice somebody to hit it through there against the spin, or with somebody waiting in front to catch, then that's a good tactic as well. But stick to your own plan first, then adapt it if somebody is coping with that. Use your field settings, invite somebody to drive, but don't do it as an open door policy. Don't just chuck it up there and hope for him to drive one down the throat of somebody, because it doesn't work like that.
The general rule which I've heard, which I don't necessarily agree with 100%, but it's a good rule of thumb, I think, is when you're trying to pick your length, is the one that's far enough back to make the batsman still play forward. So it's you're trying to bowl it as short as possible that the batsman will still play forward as a spinner.
Which is
a good general tip, I think. But I think if it's turning big, I think the one limitation of that tip is that if it's turning big, you can fall into the trap of wanting to watch the ball turn, because you're a spinner, so you think, well, I want to see the ball turn, and then you end up bowling a little bit too short, and it's not going to get you a wicket because it's turning too big. So that would be my limitation on that tactic. But generally, I think that's a fairly good piece of advice. It's soapbox time on the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, and every week somebody gets 60 seconds to rant, discuss, talk or chat about just about anything that they want. This week it's Berners. Berners, over to you.
You know, watching things like cycling, BMX, equestrian, what else have we got? Rowing, sailing, all these taekwondo events. I can't help but feel that cricket should be in the mix there. I think it would be a fantastic proposition for the game of cricket globally. We all know the power of the Olympics and just allowing the countries in some areas to come together. We've seen it with Team GB with the football, so we're bringing in the Scottish and the Welsh players. We're all playing under one umbrella. I think it would be lovely to see the West Indian states play off their own backs, so Jamaica against Bermuda, and obviously there's the great anticipation of India as well. You know, typically not so great in the Olympics. What could this do to inspire a nation and get a couple of more gold medals across the line than winning the Olympic cricket T20 competition, which I think should be live and direct from Rio the next time we have an Olympics festival.
Okay, so that's the end of the show this week. A couple of things we need to do before we disappear back into the ether. And one of those is to decide on our competition winner this week. The best question of the week wins a prize, which is an online coaching course courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. So, Gareth, which of the two questions did you prefer this week?
Two great questions again this week. But I think Paul's question's really good, because when you look around the clubs playing club cricket, how many do get their practice ethics right? How many do get their training ethics right? In every club, there's going to be people that want to do it right. And we all know that that's the right way to go. So hopefully Paul's taken some advice from what we've said on here, how to go about it. And also other people are listening in. And it would be interesting to see if people do make those changes now off the back of Paul's question. So, yeah, Paul wins it this week.
Congratulations, Paul. And every now and again, we do hear from clubs who have managed to turn the culture around. We had a email a while back from a club called Waltham St Lawrence, who put in a they're just a little village club, but they managed to install a professional style training culture within the restrictions that they had. So it definitely can be done, and if you're doing it at your club, please do get in touch with us and let us know. You can also send in your questions if you want to win a prize. And Berners, what are the details for someone who wants to get in touch with us?
You can give us a call, the number 02088 167 691, or drop us an email, and the address is coach@pitchvision.com.
That's right, and our Twitter is PV Cricket Coach, and you can find us on Facebook If you do a search for Pitch Vision Academy, you'll find us that way. Speaking of searching for Pitch Vision Academy, while you're doing that, you might as well open up your iTunes, do a search for Pitch Vision Academy in there and click on subscribe, and you'll get the show delivered to you every week, no matter what. It comes out every Friday. If you don't want to listen in iTunes, if you head over to pitchvision.com/academy, then you can go click on the podcast link and you can find all the details of how to subscribe in any other podcast feed reader. So, Berners, you've got a tail ender this week. I'm interested to know what it is.
I have indeed. And it's one that took me a little bit of a long time to actually fathom out. But I was playing a game a few months ago, and there was a couple of Australian lads, and they kept on putting out a call of boarding pass, boarding pass. Guy eventually succumbs to his dismissal. We're in the middle. I asked the guys, what's all this boarding pass business? They said, simple. Big waffer outside of on the front foot, this guy was. He said, boarding pass, let's get this guy through the gate.
Oh, I like that one. You heard that one before, Gareth?
Funnily enough, no.
All right, chaps. Well, that's all for this week. So until next time, we'll see you next week. Cheers, Gareth. Cheers, Berners.
Cheers, fellas.
Cheers, guys.